All right, so tonight, as I mentioned on the WhatsApp, we're going to be studying what I call one of the greatest anonymous Musar thinkers, Musar writers in history. Anybody want to take a stab at who I'm talking about? I know I said anonymous, but that's why I put anonymous in quotes.
Anonymous Musar?
So it was someone...
Monsieur Lassie Sharp.
Neither of those people is anonymous. Mark guessed Nefesh HaChaim, and my father guessed Monsieur Lassie Sharp, but we... very well know and always have known who wrote them. Not only do we know that we always knew, Nefesh HaChaim was written by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, and Mesillas Yesharim was written by Ramchal. There was never any question about that. And there's not really any question about the author that I'm talking about, but during his lifetime, there was a little bit. There was a man who was born during the first, at the end of the First World War. He actually was born to a secular family. And then eventually became from, at a young age, went to many, many different yeshivas, and eventually became the Mashkiach Ruchani of a yeshiva called Be'er Yaakov, and then later on, Lakewood Yeshiva in Israel, and he rose to prominence, but all the Sfarim that he wrote during his lifetime, they're all anonymous. But it's a joke, because everybody knew who wrote them. And part of the reason you knew who wrote them was because, and I experienced this, because to get one of the Sfarim that he wrote, at least, there was nowhere to buy it, except at his house. So you knew that if you wanted a copy of Ali Shur, you went to Shlomo Volbi's house in Givat Shaul in Yerushalayim, and you went to get it. And that's what I did. I went to Yerushalayim. I was in Yerushalayim, and I went to Givat Shaul to go to Rav Shlomo Volbi's house. And I knocked on the door. I love to tell the story. Knocked on the door, and in my broken Hebrew, I said to the man who opened the door, I said, I'd like a copy, and he would say, at the Sefer Ali Shor. And I was speaking to Rav Volbi, and he said, okay, I'll go get it. Meanwhile, his gabbai, who was standing right next to him, so he scolded me. He looked at me very sternly, and he said, Ali Shur. Lo Ali Shur. Ali Shur. Because that's the name of the Sefer. It's not Ali Shur, it's Ali Shur. It's a reference to Yosef HaTzadik. But either way, Rav Shlomo Volbi, he wrote several Sfarim during his lifetime, and in none of them does it actually mention his name. Ali Shur is one of the most famous Musar works.
Where did he live before you came to Israel?
Different places. He lived through the Second World War, and apparently he was in Sweden for a little while. He was saved by being in Sweden. He was a rabbi in Sweden before he came to Israel. And he's one of the most famous Musar thinkers of the last 30, 40 years. He kind of picked up the mantle from Rav Dessler. He wrote many Sfarim, most prominently Ali Shur, but he also... wrote a set of essays called Ma'amarei Yimei Ratzon. And these are very interesting. They compiled this, I think, at the end of his life. You can see that on the inside, what it says is Ma'amarei Yimei Ratzon, Chelek mitoch Ma'amarei Chachma u'Musar she'nemru b'siyata d'shmaya u'bizchut ha'rabim b'yeshiva ha'kadosha Be'er Yaakov b'chodshei Elul u'bimei Hadin. So it's telling you when they were written, or when they were said. And then it says, in other words, even after he died, they still didn't write his name in the Sfarim. I think that in Ali Shur now, it does say his name, but I'm not absolutely sure. But everybody knows who wrote these Sfarim. And I wanted to go through with you, this is basically every single year, very interesting, every single year, basically starting from Shabbat Chazon, he started preparing people for Elul. So he started talking about Elul topics. And every week, pre-Shabbos, post-Shabbos, he would give a sicha on which would develop the same theme that he had spoken about the previous week. So he was developing the same theme over the course of several different weeks. And the sichot kind of were the evolution of this theme. So I was reading this past Shabbos, I was reading some of the pieces from the year Taf, Shin, Lamed Zayin to Tafshin Lamed Chet, Tishrei of Tafshin Lamed Chet. And I wanted to share some of it with you. All right? Does that sound good?
Sounds good.
Okay, yeah. It's going to be a little bit different than usual because we're going to jump around a little bit. And I invite everybody to speak. If you want to say something, take yourself off of mute. If you want to be seen, just take yourself and just show your video. Okay. So over here, this is actually the tail end of the essay.
Can you make the text a little larger, please?
Yeah, I'll make it bigger right now. This is the tail end of his essay on Shabbat Chazon. So he was actually talking about Yirmiyahu. Was it Shabbat Chazon or was it Shabbat Nachamu? Shabbat Chazon. So this is Erev Shabbat Kodesh Shabbat Chazon. So he's quoting Yirmiyahu, and he's talking about Av, and he's talking about sadness. But at the end over here, he says something very interesting, and this is going to be his theme. The theme over here is Kiruv and Richuk, being close and being far, or closeness and far, and
farness,
distance. Okay.
Distance.
He says, the entire essence of Bnei Yisrael, of Klal Yisrael, is his connection, it's our connection, to God. And he says, yeah, there are some who are close, and there are some who are far. But he says, even amongst those who are far, even in our sense of farness, there is a closeness. And he says, I'll backtrack for a second. His main question at the beginning of the essay is, how can we make Tisha B'Av into a Moed? Kara alai Moed is what Yirmiyahu says about Tisha B'Av. Oh, or he's writing something. Is he not in the room? Is he not able to get into the room?
Somebody outside.
Has he started?
You can see from the camera.
So he wonders, why is it that on Tisha B'Av we call it a Moed? And by the way, in what way does it manifest itself even nowadays that it's a Moed? Most famously?
We don't say Tachanun.
That's right. We don't say Tachanun, not at Shacharis, not at Mincha. We don't say Tachanun. And the reason why we don't say Tachanun is because it's a Moed. Now, we understand that in the future it's going to be a Moed because there's going to be a Beit Mikdash. That we can understand. But even now, we don't say Tachanun. So Rav Volbi wonders, how could that be? How can we call it a Moed?
We don't say Tachanun during Chodesh Elul, do we?
We do, sure we do. We say Tachanun during Chodesh Elul.
During Chodesh Nisan, we don't.
So how could it be that it's called a Moed? He might be in the front, Uri.
Sorry, how can what be called Moed?
How can we call Tisha B'Av a Moed? After all, it's a sad day. How can we call it a Moed? And if we want to say it's a Moed in the future, one day it will be a Moed, fine. But even now, we don't say Tachanun because it's a Moed. So how can we understand that? So he suggests, he develops this idea, and this is where it comes to fruition. He says, there is a Moed shel Richuk. Tisha B'Av is a Moed shel Richuk. It's a holiday celebrating distance from God. Now, that's very strange. How can you have a holiday celebrating distance from God? That's not something that you celebrate. It's not something you may make a Moed out of it. But it is. And he says, now we have to understand, this is really more of it, this is a really good Tisha B'Av shir, but it's a good entry into Elul as well. He says, we can understand the Gemara in Sanhedrin. You know what? Actually, we're going to skip this part. I'm going to skip this part because I want to get to further parts, and we'll skip to the end of this essay. He says that we have to keep in mind God treats us like a father treats a son, which means that he treats us with lots of rachamim. But the problem is that sometimes we feel as if there's a lack of rachamim. For example, in the following Maimar Chazal, it says, Ba'ala taher misayin oto. Ba'ala tameh potchim lo. Which means that if somebody comes to be purified, then he is supported, he's helped. God helps him. But if somebody comes to become tameh, Hashem opens the door for him to become tameh. Now, I understand that there's, you know, more support given to the person who's trying to become purified. But nevertheless, you would expect that if somebody's coming to become tamei, if God really loves us, then what should he do? He should prevent it. Why does he allow it to happen?
Free choice.
You could say free choice. But so Rav Volbi says, lo, ki gam zoi hanagatat rachama vitbarach. This is also a form of rachamim. Why? Shehabal tamei notnim lo hikashel ba'avirah chamura v'gasa. What does Hashem do if a person wants to become Tamei? Hashem allows him to become Tamei in a very severe way. He almost, he doesn't help him and support him, but he allows it to happen easily. Why? Ubahakiro chomer vegasut hachet hu tofes et atzmo la'an hu higia umitcharet v'chozer b'tshuva. Because by allowing him to sin so severely, what will happen? He'll become disgusted with himself. He'll realize how far he's fallen, and he'll do tshuva. And this is the petach to understanding why Tisha B'Av can be a moed shel richuk. Hu hu inyan churban habayit. Shad shelo nechrav habayit, Hayu b'matzav shel mikerev libam avad cheshbon. Here he's quoting Rabbeinu Yonah in Shari Tshuva, that from the depth of your heart you have given, you've lost track. You Brits have the best phrase. You lost the plot, right? You lost the plot. Avad cheshbon. So here you've lost track of what the score is. You don't even know what the score is. Now, what does that mean? What happened to Bnei Israel during the times of the Beit Mikdash, of the second Beit Mikdash, and the first? Histaklu b'pnimiutam. Each person looked into himself. V'ra'u atzmam heichal Hashem heima. Each person said, I am myself. I'm a heichal Hashem. I'm kadosh. V'lo ra'u ad kama nitma'u ad ha'chorban. They didn't know how far they'd fallen. Rav Ben David, when he restarted the Slichot this year, and I always said it also because it's in the Rabbi Soloveitchik Kinos book, he points out the first Kinos that we read, Shabbat Surumani. And the word Shabbat is very sudden.
Slichot now, you
mean? No, Kinos.
Oh, the Kinos.
Kinos, on Tisha B'Av. Yeah. Shabbat Surumani.
Yes.
Shabbat, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, is a very sudden, there's a suddenness to it. And it's very striking because how could they not have expected this? Yirmiyahu had been screaming about it for years that this was going to happen, but yet it was still a surprise, and it was a surprise to people that the Beit HaMikdash should really actually be destroyed. It was never comprehended as being an actual reality until it happened, and the reason was because people just considered everything is going to continue the way it was. Kshenechrav ha'bayit ba'avonot v'achreach hikiru et ha'richuk ha'nara b'neim levein ha'boreh. Richuk nara, when they finally saw the Chorban that actually brought home to them how far they had fallen.
Aval kasher mekirim. You can put that parallel in lots of things in life.
Yeah.
You know, if you know something's going to happen, but you don't know the reality of it until.
Right.
What the repercussions of that would mean.
Right, yeah. There's that joke. It's there's the joke about the husband and wife. Yeah? Husband and wife go to, the wife drags the husband to a marriage counselor, and they're sitting there. And the marriage counselor first turns to the husband and says, do you know why you're here? Do you know why your wife wants you to be here? And the man says, honestly, I have no idea. Everything's been going really smoothly lately. I thought we'd been, you know, really getting along very well. And the wife says, are you kidding me? We haven't spoken in 2 weeks. We haven't said a word to each other. And the husband says, yeah, that's what I mean. I thought everything's been going great.
Yeah.
So but that's the essence, right? I was going to get to this soon, but Uri, you're totally right. This is, you know, the destruction of the Chorban is even more severe, but sometimes we don't even think about it at all. Avad cheshbon, we've lost track of where we are because we're not even thinking about it. Right, we're not thinking about our relationship with God. We're not thinking about our moral and spiritual stature, and so it feels like everything's fine.
I think this year very much you can relate that to Yiddishkeit and how, you know, people are maybe further away from Yiddishkeit than they might have been because of not going to shul and no real structure
Here's my hope, Uri. I think you're right that people, I mean, I hope, I don't know, I don't hope, but I expect that people feel some kind of lack of connection because they're not able to go to shul. Some people may say they don't, but I expect that some people do. And the good news with that is it's a good feeling to have, which is what Revolvi is going to be developing over here. In other words, if a person really feels like, you know, it doesn't make a difference that I haven't been to shul in 5 months, or at least that I haven't been to a full shul in 5 months, experienced the proper davening, with singing, with chaverim, with a proper minyan. If you don't feel that, then something's wrong. But if you do feel that lack, and you feel like, you know, something's missing because of that, and even if we don't end up getting the opportunity of going to shul, then in a sense, that's the moed shel richuk that Revolvi is talking about. As long as you realize it, then you're already, and he's going to get back to that, you're already a leg up, right? You're not on the same level as those who experienced the Chorban. Because he says, Ki kasher makirim et harichuk, yesh kfar yachas v'kesher v'kirva el boi olam. When you experience the feeling of distance, there is already a feeling, a sense, that you have some kind of connection. there's a scene in the TV show Srugim. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I don't know if I can find it right now. But the TV show Srugim, so there was a scene, I think I've said this before, where one of the characters is the daughter of Rosh Yeshiva, which means she went off the derech, right? That's the plot of the show.
Yeah, I've seen it on Netflix.
There you go. On Netflix.
She went off the derech and she went to Germany and...
No, that's a different show. That's a different movie. That's Unorthodox or whatever. I didn't see that one.
Yeah, that's
something else. No, this is Srugim. And this woman who's the daughter of Rosh Yeshiva, so she goes off to Derech, and she's living by herself, and then her cousin comes to see her. And her cousin, her younger cousin, a girl, she was in Gush Katif, and she was kicked out of Gush Katif, and she's very angry. Ami just showed up. And she's very angry. She's very angry at God because they prayed and they prayed and they prayed and they prayed and they prayed. And then they got kicked out. God didn't listen to them. That's how she feels. And she's refusing to go to the Kotel because she said she's too angry at God. She's not on speaking terms with God. And this other girl, the older girl, the cousin who went off the derech, she says, you know, I envy you. I'm jealous. The girl said, why? He says, because... You have such a strong relationship with God that you feel so angry that you're giving him the silent treatment because you're so angry. But me, I've got nothing. I've got no connection with God. I'm not even angry because I just don't care. I envy your emotion, your feeling of richuk, right? Your anger at God. I envy that because I don't even feel that much. If I could feel that much, then it would be meaningful, but I don't even feel that. And so that's kind of the sense in Av. Av would be the feeling of really getting down in the dirt, of feeling that richuk from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's how Rav Obi starts. Okay?
Sorry, could I just say something? Just on
Go ahead, Barbara.
It just occurred to me that they say the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference.
Apathy or indifference, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. They're true. Hate is a very strong relationship, or strong emotion. And anybody with kids knows that kids tend to have a lot of love-hate relationships where emotions run high, and it tends to be with the people that you're closest with, that when you have a fight, right, it's very, very strong. And it just means that you have very strong feelings with that person. And that's how it manifests itself. So look at what he says over here. Look, Zoi avodatenu biyamim eila na'amod al ha'emet shal richuk shalanu, to try to actually discover the distance. Latzeit mehamatzav shal ibur chashvon, to get out of the situation, out of the state of just not paying attention at all to where we are. Humatzav shal sheker b'lishum or. There's nothing there. There's no light. Nitbonen ba'amitat matzavenu v'nir'e ki rechokim anachnu. The moment we discover our distance, that's the moment when we can start making headway back to God. Okay? All right. That's his first essay in the series. The second one is kind of an introductory one. It's interesting. He has an interesting introduction to this one. It's called Hakdama L'Sugyat Kiruv Richuk. He quotes the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov apparently said that amongst the young people, I don't know why he says specifically young people. I think old people are like this as well. But amongst the young people, there are two types of young bachurim in yeshiva. There are those who think that every idea that they hear in Torah is too simple, like it's pashut, like why did I even need that? And then there are those who think that it's just too deep and they never understand it. And he said, we need to be kind of in the middle over there. Of course, divrei Torah are simple. They're supposed to be simple, but there's a depth in them. Right. Right. Mitzad echad hem pshutim, kol kach shekasher limtzo behem chidush. Sometimes they seem so simple that it's hard to even find the chidush. Umeidach yesh behem omek rav shekasher leredet l'soktatam. And on the other hand, sometimes they're so deep that it's hard to even get to the end of it. Harei Shlomo HaMelech amar, amarti achkema v'hirchoka mimeni. I said, I'm going to be wise, but it was too far for me. Now, the Midrash says that's talking specifically about, you guys know? That line, Amarti achkama v'rechokai mimeni, v'hi rechokai mimeni, the Midrash attributes that to a certain mitzvah in the Torah. Parah aduma. Parah aduma. Shlomo said, I understand all the mitzvot, he said I was close to, and then I got the Paraduma, and I didn't understand it. And I realized that if I didn't understand this one, then I don't understand any of them, because everything is connected. Okay, fine. By the way, you've certainly heard that Midrash before, right? That Shlomo understood everything except for Paraduma. People don't know the end of that Midrash. The end of that Midrash is that there was somebody who understood everything, including Paraduma. Because the sense that you get from that Midrash is that Paraduma is completely inexplicable and no man could understand it because of its nature. But that's not the Midrash. The Midrash says Moshe Rabbeinu understood everything, including Paraduma. Right? So it's not that the Torah is completely inexplicable. It's just that Shlomo didn't understand it. There was something he was missing. Fine. Either way, he goes on to say that it's not understandable. Well, it's not the whole point of it, but it is one of the very bullet features of it. It's hard to understand.
Although Moshe understood it, there's nowhere where Moshe states the reasoning behind it, correct?
No. No.
There is nothing written anywhere to explain the reasoning behind it, if
well,
I'm correct.
Not to get too deeply into Paraduma, but it's funny that Rashi, after saying we don't understand Paraduma, gives an explanation for Paraduma, which is basically de rigueur for everybody. Everybody, after saying it's a chok, says we don't understand it. Even those who recognize that the Gemara actually specifies exactly which part of the Paraduma is not understandable. Because the Gemara says we understand most of it, but there's only one part of the Paraduma process that we don't understand. Do you know what it is? That's right. The fact that is metameh, yeah, the person who's carrying it, and is metaher, the person that it gets sprinkled on. But even that, the Kli Yakar has a whole treatise on how that's supposed to be understood. It sounds a lot like chemistry over there. But okay, fine. Let's leave Paraduma for now. What Revolbi goes on to say, he says, you know, people describe the Torah as being emet. David HaMelech says, Karov ata Hashem, v'chol mitzvotecha emet. You've heard this before. Mm-hmm. The Torah is emet. Moshe emet, v'torato emet, mitzvotecha emet. But, you know, let's ignore sounding firm for a second. What does it mean to say that the mitzvot are emet? What are mitzvot? What are they? Functionally, what are they?
Instructions.
Instructions. They're laws, right? They're laws.
Same way they have laws at home.
Thank you.
When your wife tells you that you have to do something, or the kid gets something and they have to do it.
Exactly. Exactly, David. You made exactly that point. Would anybody say, all right, I'm getting into hot water over here. My wife's rules for the house are true. They are truth.
Much more important than Torah.
My wife has a rule. My wife has a rule.
Don't clean up after them or something.
You have to. Okay, let's make a generic rule. Okay, kids, if you want to play with another game, you have to put the first game away. Okay, that's a general rule. No kids follow, but let's say that that's the rule of the house, right? My daughter's right there. She knows that they don't follow this rule, right? Ima says, you want to play with another game, you have to put the first game away. Okay, would anybody say that that rule is truth? It's a good rule. Makes sense. It's useful. It's helpful. It's good for society. But there's nothing truthful about it. Yeah, it's more of a mishpat than that, which makes it even more close to truth, I would think, because, you know, even we can understand. But it's not truth. And one could argue that about Hashem's rules also. It's hard to describe them as truth. They're good for us. We know that. But what are they? When my wife says, I want the kids to put a game away before they play with a new game, what is she really saying? Well, I just said the word, right? I want you to do that. Why? Because it's good for me. It's good for the house. It's good for the sviva. It's good for the avira in the house. That's why. Because I want you to do it, okay? And you could say the same thing about Hashem's tzivuyim. Hashem's tzivuyim are what Hashem wants us to do. Al gzeirat melech lo sheyach lahagid shehi emet.
But does Hashem want us to do them because it's good for Hashem or because they're good for us?
Certainly not because it's good for Hashem. That would be, I mean, definitely the rationalists would say not because it's good for Hashem, but because it's good for us.
Yeah.
But in that case, he wants us to do what's best for us. Yeah. But why call it truth? Why is it the word to be used for it?
Well, it's true. A truth denotes something that is that comes from Hashem. Just because anything that if it comes from Hashem, that's indisputable. It's not.
But what do you mean? What do you mean by indisputable then?
Well, truth is something that's indisputable. You can't. Truth is truth.
But it's funny to describe mitzvot as indisputable. Math is indisputable. History is indisputable, so to speak.
That's all in the same way.
But mitzvot, what would be disputable? What would you dispute about don't eat milk and meat together?
That is beyond.
Isn't it to do? Can I? Sorry. Rav Dani?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Something to do with the way the world works, the sort of underlying structure of reality. If that doesn't sound too, you know, and that the mitzvot are, if we understood how things really work, not right. Just superficially but deeply. It's like they say that the avot kept the mitzvot without knowing them.
That's right.
You know, before the Torah was given.
That's right.
Because they intuited how the world is structured and what needs to be done, how it should be, behave.
I think that's a great approach. I think that's a correct approach from that perspective. In other words, if you take the, it doesn't need to be quasi-mystical, but definitely the quasi-mystical approach of mitzvot impacting the world in that way, then certainly that would solve our problem. Revolbi goes in a different direction. Revolbi says they're emet in what they do to us. And what does he mean? He says, David HaMelech Alav HaShalom Hirgish B'kol Mitzvah She'asah Shem Hi Madlika Nitzotz Shel Emet B'libo. Says, when I do the mitzvot, they ignite in me emet. They reveal truths about me. In other words, it's not the mitzvah itself that is truth, but rather the performance of the mitzvah generates an experience of truth. It reveals specifically our connection to God. That's what it reveals. By doing the mitzvah, we create a connection to God, which is an experience of truth, because God is truth. God is indisputable. V'zoyis gulatan shel divrei Torah. Oops. Shelukulam, this is his point over here, getting back to the simple or deep. Shelukulam yesh koach lahadlik bekerev ha'adam nekuda achat shel emet. Kol od shelo higishu zot, lo higiu adayin lahavanat divrei Torah. He says, just like the mitzvot can do that, so too divrei Torah. If you hear a divrei Torah, if you think it's too simple, or if you think it's too far from you, you just haven't gotten to the nekudah shel emet in it. If it's too simple, and you think, I knew that already, then you haven't understood it properly, because it hasn't ignited in you some kind of experience of truth, some kind of epiphany. Hen kol devar Torah mevarer ezo sugya. Every devar Torah explains some kind of I don't want to say metaphor, but some kind of sugya in life. And he points out, you know, it's easier to do this with a gadita than it is with halakha, but it can be done with halakha as well. Rabbi Soloveitcher was an expert at that, in gleaning messages from halakha that other people would never have seen. Now he says, now getting back to the original point, when we talked about the moed shel richuk of Tisha B'Av, sheyesh kirva veyesh richuk, veyesh nadarga shlishit, there's closeness, there's distance, and then there's, I'm not even thinking about it. Ibud cheshbon, not even thinking about it. So he says, a person who's in that state of ibud cheshbon, who ro'eh atzmo karov ma'od u'be'emet u'meruchak v'gamrei. He may think of himself as being close, but he's really very far. U'kshu nochach la'akir kol atzmat harichuk shelo, he may be mitzta'er, when he realizes how far he is, he'll feel pain, but then at least he'll get out of the matzav of ibud cheshbon, of not knowing. And then he goes on and he says, that's going to be a nikudat emet balev. I'm just going to skip ahead because I see how late it is. Here.
go back, there was an interesting line that he said there.
Yeah.
Because it's almost the opposite of what he'd been saying before. He said, first the person who actually feels it in his heart, then he'll understand the Dvar Torah, as opposed to the other way around, that if he understands the Dvar Torah, then he'll have that connection.
Which part are you reading?
As opposed to the other way around. It's like first he has that feeling in his heart and then he'll understand it.
I understood that line as meaning when he feels the truth, when he experiences the truth, then he knows that he properly understood. Not that it helps him understand. Okay. Okay. That means you have to work at it. You have to work at it. Until, yeah, you have to be looking for the truth. You have to work at it. You know, I experience this sometimes because recently, because I've started to do, David knows this, I've started to do like a 2-minute taste of Rashi in the morning after the 6:15 minyan. I have to look at Rashi's on the Aliyah of the day. So I try to do Rishon on Sunday, Sheni on Monday. And sometimes the days are very short aliyot, sometimes they're very large. Sometimes the aliyot are rich with, you know, good stuff. Sometimes they're just not, right? But I've got to read through the Rashi's quickly and try to find something there that I can at least spend 2 minutes and make people feel like they learned something that they didn't know before. Sometimes it's not easy. Like you read a Rashi and you're like, okay, he's just explaining what the pasuk says. But I realize when I'm reading, if Rashi was just explaining what the pasuk said, he wouldn't have written it. That's not what Rashi was doing. Sometimes Rashi is too simple. Sometimes Rashi is too hard. But there's always something in there that you're supposed to glean from, right? What's bothering Rashi? Yeah, there is, and there's got to be something. Yeah. Although that's a machloket exactly what Rashi was doing when he wrote his commentary.
What was given was that it was never just a simple short translation. There's always something deeper.
Right, but the question is, was there really always something bothering Rashi? Was Rashi trying to give pshat in the pasuk, or Nechama Leibovitz felt that he was just trying to teach Divrei Torah based on the pesukim? He was giving these are ikar ideas that he wanted to give over. But okay, that takes us far afield. I don't want to get into that. My point being, though, that sometimes you read Divrei Torah and you're like, what can I get out of this? But with a little effort, you really can see something new every single time. The Gemara says, "Ein bit midrash below chidush." Even if you learned it already, every time you learn it, there's something new to learn from it. I can say even on the level of drasha, sometimes when I'm giving a drasha that I've prepared in the middle of the drasha, I figure out something new, and then I have to say it, otherwise I'll forget it. But there's always like that's always exciting when like in the middle I'm like, oh, you know what? Now something makes sense that I never even thought of before, and I prepared this. Yeah, what do you want to say, Ami?
One of the cornerstones of yesterday's the whole idea is that there's always, by going into it, because they're doing it lishma, there was a new idea that was coming out.
Right. So. Right. Let me just make one final point, I think, because we'll end over here. He goes into, and this is really important that we shouldn't skip over this. Maybe I'll preface this. Every single moed has a theme. That's obvious. Pesach is Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Sukkot is the Emunah and the Sukkot themselves. Lulav, Etrog, whatever. Shavuot is Matan Torah, Purim, Hanukkah. And to a certain extent, we know what Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippurim are about, right? It's Yom Adin. It's Yom Arachamim. It's Slicha. It's Kapara. It's Tshuva. It's Tzedakah, right? Melucha. We know what it is all about. But if you had to sum up Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and to an extent Sukkot, together, I would say this is actually the holiday of God. Mm-hmm. And more so than Pesach, Shavuot, Purim, Hanukkah. Shavuot, to a certain extent, is about Torah. Pesach is about Yitzhak Mitzrayim, it's about nationhood, right? Purim is about Hashkacha, and it's about being saved, right? Chanukah is about also about Torah, about destiny, about history, right? But Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, if there's ever a time for a modern Orthodox Jew to just cut the garbage and actually talk about God, not garbage, cut the superficiality or technical stuff and just talk about the Ikar, which is God, this is the time. Right? We usually shy away from it. Right? There's that joke about the rabbi told not to talk too much about God. But this is a time to talk about God. So let's touch on that for just a second. The Rambam has a whole, most of his Mor Nevuchim is dealing with the question of why does the Torah use physical language for God? Why does it use anthropomorphism for God? Talks about his hands, talks about his legs, talks about his mind, talks about him being angry, being happy, being sad. Him regretting things, right? When these things, he doesn't have hargashot, he doesn't have any of these things. So the Rambam's position was exactly this is minyach yisod ki hakadosh baruch hu. Sorry, kidei leharchik mehatorah inim shal hagshama. The Rambam says that the whole point of this is so that we should understand it, right? And the Rambam says that this explains why unkelus. Unkelus, every time there is a verb attributed to God is doing something, he pulls back and he makes it like ki'ilu. For example, when it says Vayered Hashem al Har Sinai, that God came down on Har Sinai. Did God come down? Where was he before? He really came down? So Unkelus says, V'hitgalei. He became revealed. Mm-hmm. The Rambam says that's called Richuk Hagshama. It's avoiding the materializing of God. So the Rambam says, as a rule, that's what we try to do. But the Maharal takes a different tactic. The Maharal says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himid be'emza u'bamerkaz ha'olam et ha'adam. God put man in the center of the world. V'akol nimdad b'medidato shel ha'adam. And everything is measured from man. V'gam ha'Torah kadosha ma'amida b'merkaz et ha'adam. The Torah also puts man in the middle. K'shakadosh Baruch Hu natan aseret ha'dibrot b'nivu'a l'klal Yisrael. Umnam mitzido yitbarach en kol yirida. Ki hu yitbarach nimtza b'kol makom b'shaveh. But from man's perspective, it did feel like Hashem came down. And even if it just meant that God revealed himself, let's leave that alone. The absolute thing that happened was that God simply revealed himself. But it felt to us like they had entered the scene, like he had come down. From our perspective, that's what it looked like. Right. There's not a hagshama. This is not materializing God. It's just saying this is how we experienced it. Now, what does he want to do with this? He says, Yesh richuk, yesh kiruv, yesh richuk, hakol mitnoe ben kiruv v'richuk, ve'efo anu omdim yitbarer rak shenekudat ha'emet. When we talk about us and God, and this is where he's going to go with this later, when we say I'm close to God or I'm far from God, what are we really describing? Because ultimately, God's everywhere. You can't be far or near to God. He's everywhere at all times. He's always as close or as far from us at all times the same. What are we describing? We're only describing our feeling. And Rav Volbe uses it in a bunch of different places. I remember there's a phrase that he has in Ali Shur where he talks about how the sun is always shining. It's always shining. It's just that sometimes there are clouds in the way. But the sun is always equally shining. It never stops shining, and it never changes in the way that it shines. It's just that there's sometimes clouds in the way, that's all. But it's always in the same place doing the same thing. In a way, that's God. God is always there in the same way. It's just our experience of him changes, mostly because of ourselves. Our richok and our kiruv. Okay? And the moment we realize that there's a richuk, right? The moment you realize that there's a cloud in the way, then you realize, okay, I can do something about this. I have to do something about this. But if you just go around thinking, okay, you know, this is what the sun does. The sun is dark all the time. Then you'll never know. All right, we'll continue this next time. Yeah, I think this is a good theme. Shkoyach, nice. Everyone. Does anybody have anything they want to share?
Shkoyach, nice, very nice.
Okay. Go ahead.